Hi, everybody. This is your co-host, Stu, and I'm here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Hi, Patty. How are you tonight?
I am doing great. How are you tonight?
As well as can be expected for somebody of my advanced age.
Oh,
I think I've said that before, but yeah, I'm going to recycle a little bit. So we'd like to thank all of our viewers and listeners for being with us for this episode. And if you would please, if you haven't already, click the subscribe button that's down below. Click the bell on YouTube to let them know that you like our content. You like to see other things just like it. Hopefully a lot more of us. We also have the Linktree where we have all of our information about the Facebook groups, the email address, and even Patty's WordPress blog is on there now too. So hopefully you can check that out. And with that, I'm going to be surprised with what you're going to tell us that we're going to do this time.
So I've decided to start, not every time, but every so often, about once every month, I'm going to visit a different state. And so I chose Alaska. Alaska happens to be a state that I'm fascinated with. Uh-huh. I have always been fascinated with it, and it has more cool stories than you could possibly imagine. In fact, we're probably going to have to break it into two different podcasts because literally – there are more cryptids in Alaska than I think any other state in the union. And it's got so many other things that's fascinating about it. For example, it has twice as many missing people as any other state, even though it has much less population.
Well, when you consider the sheer acreage of the state, you know, that's, mm-hmm. you know, it can be a dangerous place. I know my Mrs. Stu's one brother and his wife are just on their way back from a vacation in Alaska right now. So that's amazing that you picked Alaska.
But, wow. Yeah. Well, I hope they didn't run into any of my cast of characters for tonight.
I don't think so.
So I thought we'd start out with some of the cryptids. Now, I'm going to start out with some of the ones that you could just say were like parents teaching their kids not to do certain things. Obviously, Alaska, the frontier there in the wilderness, is very dangerous. So there are some historical characters such as the, and I'm going to say it to the best of my ability, I apologize if I mispronounce anything tonight, the Kupalak, and it is a half woman, half fish, if you will, creature that the Inuits talk about. She can come on land with her legs, and she can, but she always returns to the water and becomes half fish again. She's known for stealing children, particularly children who wander close to the shoreline. So the mothers would warn the children, don't go near the water. And she supposedly has a pouch on her back that would allow her to carry her baby. And she would steal a child and put into that pack, a small child, and then spirit them down into the water and away from the parents, and the parent would never see them again. So they would warn the children to stay away. This is a very traditional story. The Adit is another that comes from the Inuit stories, and it's about a human being with a lower half of the body of a dog. So upper torso, human, waist down, dog. And it was created when an Inuit woman mated with a dog, siring five pups and five of these Aduits. And the story says that she refused many suitors to marry her dog husband. And in the end, she and the dog husband perished, but her children thrived and they continue on to this day. I don't know if that means that they bred or if they're just the original ones. There's nothing to explain that. They are found in other parts of the world, such as British Columbia, Siberia, and Greenland, where the stories also were popular. Now, my next one is one that I'm really fascinated with. These are the Iccantarats. And I have to tell you that what it means is little people of Alaska. This is one of my creepiest, in my personal opinion, beings. I don't know what it is about like little gnomes and elves and stuff, but I find them quite creepy. I always have. So everywhere in the world has its stories. This is a universal set of stories, from the little 1-foot elf all the way to the 2 or 3-foot high gnome you see them all around the world, and Alaska is no exception. And theirs are just as difficult to understand. Some of them are impish and funny. Some of them are vicious and deadly. Some of them play tricks. Some of them reach out at the most unexpected moments and help humans. And I wanted to tell some stories of these, because there are so many of these stories. And these are not just stories from 100 years ago or 300 years ago. These are happening right up to today. So these are not just these fascinating creatures from a long time ago. So the first story I'm going to tell you is by a gentleman by the name of Sean Ashwaktopak, who is a professor. He tells the story about two hunters that climbed up a mountainside. They looked down into the valley and saw the little people harvesting caribou. And they were shocked because they're about 2.5 feet tall, and yet they could pick up a dead caribou and drag it. They knew that they should not interact with the little people, so they sat there and watched. Eventually, they went home, and when they got home, they were shocked because everything had changed. Their parents were gone. Their friends were old men. And there was a villager who recognized them as the boys who had disappeared and they thought had died long ago.
Wow. Yeah.
Now, if you remember, in New York, along with the Headless Horseman, there was another story that he told, the author told. And his was of a story of encountering these dwarves and playing eight ball, which was basically like bowling, eight pins with them and drinking with them. And for every cup of drink he had, the main character aged 10 years. And so when he went home, his daughter, who had been an infant, was now an adult woman. His wife had died, and all of the villagers in his little town had aged by 40 years.
Hmm.
So this is not an unknown story feature. Interestingly enough, this comes from many different parts of the country or the world, actually. These beings, now to give you a kind of a view on who they are and what they are, they come from the size of about a foot. There are some very small ones, but the vast majority of them sound to be about 2.5 feet tall. They dress in caribou skin, sometimes with some cast off human clothing. You'll hear some stories of them, like with an old raggedy coat and the caribou pants and boots. It's as though they are picking up cast off clothing out of maybe perhaps our garbage dumps or something to make use of them. And they apparently live in underground burrows and hunt with bows and arrows. They possess human qualities. They're incredibly strong. They can run very fast. They steal a great deal of what they have or take what they want or need. So there are literally dozens of stories and dozens and dozens and dozens of hunters who shoot a caribou or an elk or whatever, and they run, you know, up to the area where they just had their kill, only to get there to find it is missing. No tracks, or perhaps just small human-like footprints, and the bloody spot where the animal fell, as though they have come and secreted it away in that couple seconds it took to run up there. Now, I thought that it was really interesting because one of the stories I read early on was probably the only really nice story I had read. So back in like 1946, there had been a really bad time of hunger for the Inuit in the area. The crops had failed, what they had managed to grow. The caribou and stuff weren't moving in their direction. It was just really lean times and people were hungry. And there is a story about how these hunters went out. And they were looking for tracks, for spoor, whatever they could find to show them that they could get to some, to kill some animals to feed their families. Frankly, they were going to starve to death if that didn't happen. And the story goes that the little people appeared to them in the distance and waved them on, like, come on, come on, come on. And out of desperation, they followed this group of little people, knowing that it could just as easily have been to their own death. But mm-hmm. they took the chance. And they followed them. And the little people came to the top of this hill, and they pointed down into a valley and scurried aloft off on the side. And the men came up and they looked over and they saw a huge herd of caribou down in that valley, enough to feed them for weeks and weeks and weeks. And they went down and they slaughtered the caribou, and they packed the meat on the sleds and took it home. And they would later say that they owed their thanks to the little people who had shown them where the food was so that they survived. A very singular act of kindness, considering there's so many other stories where I was listening to a story here just yesterday, where it was a young man. This was took place in the early 2000s, and he and his girlfriend were going to visit her family, her grandparents, and spend a day or two and then go back home. And they got there, and while he was there, he participated in a hunt and was drying meat for them, started the drying process, you know, stripped the meat down and was hanging it over the smoldering fire. And he's sleeping, taking a turn at sleeping while everybody else is, you know, tending the fires and keeping it going. Because there were several hunters. So there were several elk or caribou. And he woke up and he saw a figure standing in the doorway of this little hut that he was sleeping in. So apparently the grandparents had like a main structure that was their home, and then like another side structure that would have been used for relatives to visit and what have you. And so he was sleeping in there. His wife was, or girlfriend was sleeping beside him. And he sees this, what looks like an old woman. And at first he mistakes it as a grandmother, the grandmother. And he calls out to her, "Is everything okay? Do you need my help?" And the figure doesn't answer, but it turns around and just very quickly disappears. And he thinks, "Well, that's so odd. Why didn't she talk to me?" So he jumps out of bed and he goes running out, and it's about 80 yards between the two little huts, and there's nobody there. There's no footprints there. And he turns around to go back in, and he sees on the corner of this little stand where they had been hanging the meat in the yard, a little man about a foot tall. And the little man is trying to pull the meat off the lower racks as though he's trying to steal it. And just that moment, as he's looking at that and he doesn't know what to do, do you yell? What do you do? These things are known to be dangerous. He hears this sound again and he looks and he calls her grandmother, and a grandmother, not the grandmother, a grandmother-like figure suddenly comes rising up from a foot tall to about 3.5 feet tall, as though it's growing in front of him. And as he's distracted, the little figure steals more meat and takes off running. Now, that's one of the things that's interesting, is these things are shapeshifters, because they can change their shape into tall people. They can be as tiny as a foot tall. One story I read was that they would hit themselves. They said beat themselves. That's their exact word. And they would grow to the size of a man. And they would carry with them two sets of clothing. The set of clothing that was the size they are normally, and the human size set of clothing, so that they could blend in if they needed to go into areas where there were humans. And then when they would get back home and they would shinny back into their little hovels under the ground, they would tap their heads on the top of the roof and it would make them shrink again small. And some sort of a shape-shifting thing.
Very curious.
It is very, I thought it was fascinating. There's a story that was published in the early 90s in the Anchorage Daily News. This is a story of a guy by the name of Kenneth Ashby, who talks about when he's an old man in this story, as he's telling the story to the reporter. And he talks about back in 38, that he and his brothers and some friends were attacked by a group of feral people, 3 foot tall, with bull-style haircuts draped in caribou skins, as they were out prospecting. After a fierce struggle, they managed to escape the creatures, which were distracted whenever two other men arrived. He said that The same summer, his sister had been chased off a group of these same creatures trying to steal her salmon as she was fishing on the river. And he said that about 9 years later, he was camping with another group of relatives on a hunting trip when during the night they heard the crunching of leaves and they thought somebody was outside. So they went out to inspect to see who was, you know, moving around their camp. As everybody who should have been in the camp was inside of the structure they had built. And they found nobody. They began to hear these strange whistling sounds like birds twittering in the night. And the older men said, "Don't go back out, that this is the little people." And they wouldn't let them go back out. And they said, "We would hear them scurrying around outside." In the morning when they came out at daylight, they found that these creatures had stolen the meat they had hung the night before. And all that was left was the footprints. So in the same area, there was a woman by the name of Flora Penn who was traveling with some friends when they stopped to pick berries. Suddenly they noticed a tiny man with a large bulbous nose and pointy ears and a cone-shaped head. Now think about it, that's a classic elf, isn't it? Classic.
Mm-hmm.
Sitting on a driftwood pipe, on a driftwood piece of driftwood, smoking a pipe. She watched a curious man for almost an hour, and the whole time he smoked his pipe and just looked around. Suddenly, the little man seemed to be spooked by something and jumped bolt upright off the driftwood and took off running towards the mountains at a terrific rate. She could barely keep him in sight for quite a while. Another story of this was that they were a gentleman talking about a caribou hunt. After they bagged a caribou, him and his buddies, they skinned it, and they heard what they said was a voice of someone speaking in the Eskimo language. He looked to see who it was, and the voice came from a diminutive man, 3 feet tall, armed with a bow and arrow. The two exchanged a brief comments and inspected each other's weapons. They basically was kind of eyeballing the gun, and the other guy was eyeballing the bow and arrow. And he said he was armed with a high-powered rifle at the time. He said, "I thought the Inuit's bow was too tight for him to pull, and he imagined it must take tremendous strength to work this bow." The hunter told the mysterious stranger that he could not take what he wanted of, or that he could take what he wanted of the caribou, but just to leave some fatty parts for them so that they could have food as well. The being walked up, began to cut at the caribou, took a large chunk, and walked away, completely disdaining to pay attention to them again. And you hear stories like this all the time. Now, you might think, okay, that's cool, that's interesting, but let's get real. These are old men telling old stories from a long time ago, but they're not just old men. There's a town, there's actually a TV show called Missing in Alaska, and they did an episode, and in the episode they visited a town where the little people are often seen. At Halloween, the little people seem to be more mischievous than normal, and they will steal children. And they interviewed 3 people. So there was this one was a woman whose daughter disappeared from her backyard, and she saw one of these figures with the caribou pants and coat and everything, 3 foot tall, running back toward the woods. She ran outside, recognizing what it was, and looked, and her child was missing, and her child was never found. Then they interviewed people in town who said that you stay off the streets at night, particularly in the fall, which would be Halloween time, because these beings will carry people away. So for trick or treat, you go at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, knock on a few houses, and then you go home, and everybody's locked their doors before 6 or 7 o'clock at night. Now, they interviewed the police chief there, and he told this really bizarre story. So he's an English man. So he's not, you know, not Inuit, he's not a native person. And he's there working as the police chief. And he said, "When I first heard the stories, I thought, you know, cutesy folklore kind of stuff. Until one night, 7 to 8 months after he took the job, he's out patrolling. It's Halloween. He's expecting it to be busy. And to his absolute shock, he really wasn't busy at all, because everybody really did lock their doors about 4 o'clock in the evening, and there was nothing happening. You know, normally on Halloween night, the cops are all out and they're cruising along, checking to make sure there's no mischief or nothing happens. It's bad. Well, he's out there to do the same thing, but there's nothing to police because there's no people. So he's walking along and he looks up and he sees a little man with a fur coat and fur pants and this weird looking little triangular fur hat about 2.5, 3 feet tall on top of a house. And that's enough to slow you down. You know, you're like, what the heck? And he walked up to this fella. It was just beginning to get dusk. And he yelled, "Hey, what are you doing up there?" And the figure looked at him, made this weird, startling chirping sound, and dove off the other side of the house. He ran around the house to the other side, and there was nothing there. And he's like, "I think I'm a believer now." So, you know, there are so many of these stories. I was really, really shocked by how many such stories there are. The Little Men is one of the most easily found sets of stories you will find. And there are lots of them. There are just like whole villages of them that sometimes turn out. So this is a story that is timeless, going back hundreds of years and literally up through the 2000s. So our next one is called the Kilut. It's an evil spirit. It takes the form often of a hairless dog. The only hair on this animal would be on its feet. It's terrifying. It's a malevolent spirit. It reminds me very much of the stories of the black dogs and shucks and what have you. It will harm you. It's malevolent. It will kill you. It will steal your soul. It'll bedevil you for years if you see it and you run away from it. It can follow you. And once it follows you home, it'll literally haunt you for unknown periods of time. And they continue to say that these animals exist to this day. The next is, it's called a people stealer, and it comes from the Kenai Peninsula, and the name is so difficult, Sodana Yamyanasa, and I can spell it if anybody wants me to, but I can't say it very well because it's a long word with lots of consonants. Anyway, this thing takes a human form. It's a shapeshifter, and they wear fur clothing, and they have very long noses, which are almost a foot in length. So you can definitely tell them. Can you see that? I mean, like, it's like a Pinocchio nose. And they will lure you with bird songs or animal sounds and get your attention. And then once they pull you away from whatever the society's at into the woods to look for whatever it is you're looking for, you know, you think you're hearing, they will spirit you away. They will steal you. They are only active during the long summer months. They steal people all the time, from what the legends go. And once you've been taken by one of them, you never come back. There's never anything found of you. You just completely disappear.
Think so. Twice about going to Alaska. Right?
I'm telling you, there's a lot of crazy stories in Alaska. So the next one's my favorite, the Kushnika. The Kushnika means literally otter man. And there are I know it sounds crazy, but if you can imagine an otter that can morph itself into a human-sized otter, it sounds insane, but there are so many stories of these Kushnika. So there's a gentleman by the name of Harry P. Culp who wrote a book called The Strangest Story Ever Told, and he talks about something called the Thomas Bay Devils incident in this book. And it says, I'll read you exactly what he describes. He says that he was a prospector. He and himself, they had gone, and some other people, I'll read it exactly. The author relates this horrific tale about three prospectors and himself who had caught an up-close and personal encounter with this huge, hairy, creature that almost killed them in 1901. Now, the book was published in the late 1920s, so it would have been years later. The four men, he names them as Fred, Charlie, John, and Harry, were told that there was gold in the Thomas Bay area by an Indian guide that they knew. So they went to the area to find gold. And Charlie, the gentleman who is the author of the actual story itself, was excellent at prospecting. He had lived off the land for years. There's one particular area that the native guide told them to particularly look at, but it was a lot further out than the rest of the area that needed to be investigated. So they decided to split up. And Charlie decided he would take the furthest route because he was the best at being on his own in the bush. So he goes out, he's got his little canoe, he's paddling along, gets to the area, and has his supplies with him. And he's supposed to find some bit of gold. If he can find just a little bit of gold to bring back so they can get it assayed and they'll know how rich this area is and what have you, then they'll focus on that area. If not, and one of the other guys comes back with better gold, that's where they're going to focus. It's kind of the premise of the whole thing. Now, what ends up happening is Charlie comes back about 3 days later. He is absolutely terrified. He's telling them, he's like, I found a bit of gold, but I ain't going back there. Ain't no way, no how, you can't make me. And he tells this crazy story about how he had been out prospecting and this otter creature, the size of a man, with these weird long feet and these long claws, not hands, claws, came out of nowhere and it attacked him. And he has this little tiny bit of gold in his pocket yet. And he shows it to him and he's like, but it ain't worth it. It just ain't worth it. And they're like, you know, I don't know what you saw, but, you know, you're just crazy. It's you. But here's the thing. He pulls his shirt off and there are these long, gorged out scratches on his back, the length of his back. And he shows them the shirt, which was cut to ribbons. And at that point, he's like, I'm not going back. There's no way, no how, there's nothing. There's no money in this world that would convince me to go back there. And he left and he never came back. And they, after seeing how terrified this guy was, they decided that they probably didn't want to go up in that valley and meet whatever that was that shredded his back either. It was, you know, just an interesting story about how this happened. Another one happened in 1925 when, and this one made the rounds. It was a very popular story. At one point, there was a trapper and his dog. They went up into Thomas Bay area, and he was looking to set traps, you know, for hides. And he had been doing this for years, this fella. He knew what he was doing. He'd lived in the bush for a long, long time. While he's up there, his dog disappears, which makes no sense to him because this dog knew the score, and you know, you stayed with your master, and we think of dogs now as pets, but those animals were working animals. They protected the trapper. He fed them because, you know, his dog, because it did protect him, and it was company for him, and it would alert him if somebody was coming into a camp. It had a job, and the dog had never done this before, and he'd had it for quite a while. So he finishes setting up the traps, and he's calling to the dog. The dog doesn't answer. He calls for the dog. The dog doesn't answer. And he decides he's going to spend the night. And he figures, you know, the dog got caught up in something and just kind of wandered off, but it'll come back. It'll come back by scent. So he sets up a camp for the night. And in the middle of the night, he hears this terrible ruckus, the chains of the traps rattling and clanking and craziness. In the morning, he leaves his little camp. And he finds that there's traps torn up and thrown onto the land, and other traps that have been, you know, set or have been kicked off so that they're no longer set. And there's these huge footprints, not of a human, but of what he describes as long-toed, flat feet with talons at the end. And he had seen tracks for years. He could read track like nobody's business. Never seen anything quite like this. So he starts calling for the dog. He's like pulling his traps up, thinking this is just not the area. I'm going to take them and leave. And he hears what sounds like a dog barking. And this is important because these otter men things, they can whistle, they can sound like birds tweeting, they can mimic human speech, and they can bark, they can mimic animals. So he hears the dog barking, and he thinks, and he has some couple friends who are with him. That's how the story ends up getting told. And he says to his buddies, hey, I'm going to run and check on the dog. I can hear it up there in the hill, in the bush. I'm going to go up there. And he's got tangled up in something or something. That's got to be the answer. So they're like, I don't think you should go. This just doesn't look right. And he's like, nah, I got to go get the dog. It'll be fine. I can hear him barking. And he goes up, and he doesn't come back. And his buddies walk up, and there's nothing there. No dog. No man, no Kushnika. And the man's never seen again, nor is the dog. So, you know, it's a pretty interesting story. In May of 2012, there were two teenage brothers and their mother riding four-wheelers near a village in the same region. They spotted a large hairy man creature walking toward them, coming out of the woods near a place called Fox Lake. The thing was lumbering along, walking very oddly, and had a weird rounded gait. Now, here's what's interesting. Its hands went almost to its ankles, like down below its knees, like a strange kind of ape, and its face was covered with fur. But as the Studden family slows down and is watching this thing walking, it heads toward them, and there's another group of people in the region that are doing like a little Easter egg hunt, like off to the side. They freeze and they see it and they're like, oh my God, what is that? And they realize that they shouldn't be seeing what they're seeing. At this point, this creature, whatever it is, realizes it's being observed by the humans, and it takes off running back into the woods. And they described it not as a Bigfoot, but as a otter man. And there are Bigfoot stories, there's dogmen stories, there's all kinds of other stories in these woods. Dogmen are fairly popular, and we're just going to do do one more section, and then, like I said, we'll probably have to come back to this again because there's just so many stories. I could do this for 4 hours, and I won't do 4 hours no matter what, but I mean,
okay, thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. But there's just so many of them. So there are dogmen accounts in. There's actually a website called The Dogmen Encounters where a woman named Melissa wrote in. She talks about a brush with the bizarre on her drive home one morning. So she's on a winding road in an area called Trunk Road between two little towns, Palmer and Wasilla. And it's freezing cold, miserable, snowy, icy. She's trying to get home from work. And she's, you know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and she's only about 10 minutes away from home when she sees this thing. And she said she was tired. She was exhausted. She caught something moving in the headlights. At first she thought bear because it seemed to be upright. But as she got closer, it wasn't. And then she was thinking man because it was thinner. And then her headlights hit it, and she describes it as a very dark, tall figure. She says that as she slowed down, it drew closer, and she could see that it was on two legs, that it was slim, too slim to be a bear, that it had what she called spikes running down the neck and back. And she said, I could clearly see a wolfish muzzle, large upright ears. The spikes on its back were in fact clumps of fur. The spine curved in a smooth, very natural dog-like way. It was standing in a ditch inches from the pavement. Because I was focused on its upper body, I can't tell you about the back legs, but the front legs were what you would have expected a dog's legs to be, hanging over, you know, hanging down in the front. While it was clearly canine, there was something off about it, and I cannot articulate what it was. It was perfectly still at this point. Given the proximity to Halloween, I began to wonder if somebody was standing there in a costume to scare me. That was her next thought. You know, like she didn't immediately go dog man. But she said it was, you know, not that. When you get to watching it, it's moving and it's too big. It's too too different. And who is going to write mine is going to be standing out in the middle of a horrible, miserable night at 2 o'clock in the morning on the off chance that somebody is going to drive down that road to see it. You know, it's like the odds are not in the favor of this one. So she said she's driving, she's almost to a stop and examining this creature. She's looking at it, trying to make her mind up on what it is. And she said, in a tiny fraction of a second it took for it to swivel its head, I knew I had made a terrible mistake by slowing to almost a stop. The fluidness of the movement removed any doubt that it was a prop. It was horribly and terrifyingly alive. The pale white, off-white glow of the eye shine of the headlights destroyed any possibility of a human in clothing. I think I sat there gaping in shock for just a second, the car barely moving by now, but still inching closer. And as I was almost upon it, lean forward and it could touch the car if it wanted to. If it leaned forward, it could touch the car. And I had a look of its face. And he said, I'm a bad judge, but I would say I'm 5'4" and it was a hell of a lot taller than me. That's our exact words. Tall, like a polar bear standing, 7-8 feet. I really couldn't say. I snapped out of my trance and slammed on the gas. The car fishtailed and I thought, I'm going to die by this monster. I'm going to end up in a ditch and it's going to get me. But the tires finally caught on the pavement and I drove like a complete maniac the rest of the way home. It is clearly not an ordinary Bigfoot. It was not something I had seen before. It is nothing I had seen pictures of before or sketches. Whatever it was a dog on 2 feet, huge and terrifying. I just thought it was fascinating. There's another story of another creature that was just as equally scary. There's another type of Bigfoot type creature, but not a Bigfoot, from Lake Iliana. And this one is referred to as the Bushman or the Hairy Man. This creature's appearance, and this is an actual description. They range from 7 to 14 feet in height, covered with shaggy fur, said to be very ape-like. However, they have freakishly long arms down to their ankles and red glowing eyes. They can swim very well. They're blamed for the loss of livestock and pets, as well as raiding campsites or stealing fish from fishermen. The tracks of this creature are sporadically found, always near the water, and there are supposedly photographs of one on a mountain ridge taken by a hunter in 1982. And I have to tell you, as I'm going through all of this, that there are just some amazing stories of this hairy man. I wanted to tell one in particular. There was a woman who is the last person to ever claim land in Alaska through the Homestead Act. So then, and the Homestead Act ended in the early 1970s. I think it was 72, 73. And this woman and her husband had lost everything. They lived in Washington State and they had several children, and they decided that they had heard that the Homestead Act was going to end, but that they were still taking applications. So her and her husband, in an act of desperation, because they had no money, they had no jobs, they were completely desolate, lost everything. Everything they had, they literally had in the pickup truck and their kids. I can't imagine how terrifying that was. So they ended up deciding they were going to apply for a piece of ground. They got the application in time. And ended up moving to Alaska. They literally took a little bit they had and moved to Alaska. They had nothing when they got there but this piece of ground. He found a job working on an oil rig to help pay their expenses. And they ended up building what ends up becoming at first it's a homestead, and then it becomes like a ranch where you could go and rent rooms and stuff eventually over the course of time. She, in the first couple winters they were living there, they lived miles away from the nearest town, just her and the kids and her husband, and he would go away for months on end to work the pipeline, so it was just her and the kids. She tells these stories of walking with the kids and coming across these hairy men that were checking out their home. Like, she would see them coming up the through the woods, and they would circle the house, or they would be walking down the lane that she and the kids would go down to meet her husband, to go to town to get groceries eventually. And it became very terrifying for her. She goes to town one day, and she's sitting in, she gets invited to a circle, a sewing circle of Native American women. And she's sitting there sewing in the circle, very honored, because most American, you know, English women weren't invited to these Native circles. But she had been there a couple years. They knew her. They knew she was living the lifestyle and she was succeeding. So they considered her one of their own. And she's sitting there sewing, and there was this older woman who was sitting there, and she had never had a chance to ask about these big hairy creatures before, so she thought, if I can work this into the conversation, I'm asking. So somehow she manages to work it into the conversation, and this one old lady gets up and she walks out very quickly, and one of the other women scolds her, and she says, you shouldn't talk about that in front of her. And this woman's very confused, and she's like, I'm so sorry. Why? And she's like, because her sister was stolen by one years ago, and her sister never came back. And she's like, well, how do you know she was stolen by one? She said, oh, she was out picking berries, and she was captured, and we knew it was one of the hairy men. And when she was a teenager, some hunters found her. She was dressed in fur clothes, and she came back. And the upshot of the whole story is she told them she had children by this hairy man, and she wanted to go home to her family. And they locked her in the house, and they tried to like tame her back down, but she escaped back into the woods and was never seen again. And this is when she realized how seriously they took the hairy man stories. So there are a lot of them out there in Alaska. They're much bolder than our Bigfoot, and I think that's because they've had less human interaction. So they've not learned to fear the humans in the way that the ones in the north, you know, the northeast would be afraid, because they've been shot at and what have you. And apparently they can mate with humans, or they attempt to mate with humans. And this girl was stolen and became the wife, ipso facto, to one of them, and wanted to return to her family. So there are a lot of really bizarre stories, but she told that story in a book she wrote about her homesteading. And it's just a small incident in a larger book. The whole book is really about the homesteading and how they got there and how she ended up being the last person to ever file for the Homestead Act and all of that. But in amongst all of that, you come across this crazy story. And with that, I'm going to end it for tonight. We'll visit Alaska again, because believe me, I got a lot more stories to tell. So we are done.
All right. So with that, I'll say good night.
Good night.